Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help!
Hello and welcome to what I pretty much guarantee will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, a man who is a true genius in his own mind, George P. Fraser. Hello,
no
George.
No question about that, big guy. Thanks for recognizing.
Yeah, of course. I want to set the record straight. There will be no self-aggrandizing on this show unless we do something really amazing. That's the motto.
Right.
Yeah. We have a great show tonight, George. We don't always have authors on the show. I should say we hardly ever do. But our guest tonight has written a book coming out in April, and it's got quite a story.
Well, I can't wait till he's on so we can hear it.
I read the preview of the book, and the preview sounds fantastic. But his name is Stu, and we'll be bringing him on in a little bit, time permitting. But you know, George, on Real Recovery, we always like to discuss one of the 12 steps. I think tonight we're going to look at step 10.
Well, I hope Stu, is that his name, Stu?
Yeah.
Is patient, because if we get on a roll.
It could be no Stu.
You know, he might be on
next week.
There
could be
no
Stu.
Yeah.
Or next month.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
We're on step 10 tonight, and the reason we do, just for a quick review of step every week, is not that there's anything magical about the steps. They point us to Christ, but it's a way we can walk out our faith. And step 10 is continue to take our personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. We look at relapse, Bill, as walking away from God, going back to our old behaviors. And what's important is that we can identify that it's a process, it doesn't just happen, and change it. Step 10 is one of those. Am I doing what I did when I first got into recovery? Do I still have the same willingness? When people ask me to do something, am I still as willing today in my recovery as I was when I got into it? Am I doing the non-negotiables that we talk about? Am I going to God first? Before I go to man every day? Am I in the Word before I turn on the TV? Am I praying for recovery? You know, how am I walking this out? And what the deal is, if we identify that we're not doing this, we can go, gosh, I can change that. And usually how you know that is your spirit's a little unsettled. You get restless, irritable, discontent. Why? And you go over your checklist of what you do to walk out your recovery, and usually you've eliminated something.
Mm. George, when we look at step 10, does it kick us in the behind a little bit because we start to feel complacent, like, hey, we've got this thing beat?
Well,
we've got some space now, some margin in life.
I got this.
I got
a handle on this.
How many times have we heard this?
Yeah. When we work with guys and they tell us, you know, I got it now. It's like, no, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
If you think you don't have it, you know, that you have to rely on God to get it, then you're in the right place. I think what happens is people get complacent. They just get their eyes off of God. We lose our focus. Our eyes go to ourselves or our pleasure. We forgot who brought us. Bobblehead night on Real Recovery.
Well, I thought you were going to complete your sentence.
No.
That was it.
I stopped mid-sentence.
And somehow that's
okay. You never
okay.
know what I'm going to do.
So how do we keep this this daily inventory and confession of wrongdoings? How do we stay humble and aware of our imperfect natures? Because isn't that part of what step 10 is?
Sure. But there's also another piece. You know, I want to look at all the things God is doing for me, too. Am I sober today? Did I have a productive day? Do I have a roof over my head? Do I have enough to eat? So when I look at my daily inventory, I want to look at all the good things in my life too, not just the negative, Bill. But a lot of us do this, you know, before we close our eyes at night. And when we really start to grow along spiritual lines, it won't be just the acts we committed that we'll look at. It'll be some of the acts that we omitted. When I work with people and I see they're making progress and they cough up to me some things they've done, when they get to the point of recognizing what they could have done and didn't do, they're well on their way. And so there's two things here. But what we always want to go with on step 10, I believe, is looking at the things God has done for us. Are you sober today? Are you saved? You know, do you have enough to eat? Okay, what could you have done better today? You know, did you get an argument with somebody? Let's say you do a radio show with a guy and he just annoys you to no end. And then you go, well, okay, that's Bill. But, you know, could you do that in a more loving way?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're mad.
I'm just, yeah, I wished I would have known that was coming.
You know.
So, George, if I look
but
at...
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. If Galatians 5:16 says, this I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. So have you ever wondered why you're not... See, I'm stopping in the middle of a sentence now, too.
Just it's to contagious.
How, just to, so you can see how it feels.
Yeah.
Kind of hangs you out to dry, doesn't it?
I'm kind of wondering, what do I ever wonder about what?
Well, that's what I mean. I just stopped to show you how I felt.
Yeah.
You don't like it, do you?
I'm apathetic, Bill.
All right. So did you ever wonder why you're not as good a Christian as you ought to be? I mean, isn't that one of the struggles you have all the time? Why am I not as good a Christian as I ought to be?
I know why, because I don't want to be.
Okay.
And part of that is recognizing doing God's will when I want to do my own. For me, and you look at that, but I think, Bill, it's a great question in that I want to be able to really take a good look at myself. As it talks about in the book of James, you know, we can be like the man who looks at himself in the mirror and quickly, when he leaves, forget what he looks like. That's a guy that reads the word and doesn't do it. You got to be all in on this and go, okay, it's all right if I'm wrong. Remember when we had Dr. Glenn Pickering on,
mm-hmm.
and he said most addicts he works with think that they're wrong and they're bad, but they're not. They're just wrong. And I think having the freedom to go, hey, you know what, Bill? Maybe I should talk in complete sentences
for you. Yes, you should.
You know, and not make a joke about it because I'm more mature than that.
Yeah.
And maybe someday that'll happen. I doubt it.
I doubt it, too.
But I think giving yourself the freedom to mess up is a big piece of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, George, as we look at step 10, does this connect to Romans 12, 2 and 3? It says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect.
Yes.
Isn't that step 10?
It is, and what I want to look at, though, is specifically, okay, I can read that and go, okay, that's a nice idea, but what am I doing? And what step 10 isn't about a thought or a desire. It's about your actions.
Mm-hmm. So I think I could also tie in Romans 12, verse 3 that says, for by this grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned.
Absolutely.
So there's that humility that we talk about that is always necessary.
The sober judgment for me goes to the actions. Am I doing what I say I'm going to do? Did I go to church this week? Did I do my Bible study? Did I spend time in prayer? Have I worked on my recovery this week? Or am I getting enough sleep? Yes, I'm getting enough sleep. Did I get my workouts in?
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing this? Am I being kind to people? When somebody asks me to do something for them in a recovery setting, am I able to do that? Around the house, how am I? You know, am I patient with my wife and my stepkids? I am, unless there's a hockey game on, you know? I mean, we can't be perfect at this thing.
Right.
But you know, that's what you do in step 10. And you don't have to be in recovery to work these steps. Are you doing what you say you're going to do? In other words, do your actions back up your beliefs? Or is it just all in your head? Is your walk in your head, or is it really a walk? And this is the one where your talk has to match, you know, your walk has to match your talk. You got to do what you say you're doing.
Yeah.
That's step 10 to me.
Okay, good. Now, as you know, George Sue, who's going to be coming on in just a minute, was once a 300-pound narcissist. This is his description of himself.
Now he's a 200-pound narcissist?
Who knows? We'll find out if he
lost
some
weight. No narcissism on Real Recovery yet.
But he called himself an angry, atheistic alcoholic. That's kind of redundant, isn't it? I've heard this many times before.
Angry, atheistic alcoholic.
Yeah. And by the ages of 30 and 44, he had taken three companies public, on the NASDAQ, Securities and Exchange Commission. And also, at one point, he had a deal that I think put on paper 8 figures. Do you even know how much money 8 figures is?
$10 million.
Yeah. So that's a lot of money.
Minimum 10.
Yeah. Minimum of $10 million.
So this guy could hang out with us. I mean, does he golf?
Yes.
Okay.
I think he does golf. So he would be welcome in our little community.
You know what's interesting? Because just thinking about, okay, here's a guy that's worth $10 million and he's a corporate guy and they did an IPO. Sounds like a guy I'd kind of want to hang out with.
Well, definitely. This guy'd be fun.
Take us to his club?
Yes, and he'd pick up the tab for lunch.
Yeah. You know, he might even be close to private jet territory.
Yeah.
And we hang out with guys like that.
We prefer guys like that.
You know, because we like to go, did you fly commercial? You know, we don't do that.
What kind of fool flies commercial, right?
Right.
Exactly. So that is all that's going to be ahead coming up on the show. And Stu, you know, as we love having guests in studio, Stu's going to be on the phone because he lives in Colorado. And so we're going to bring him on just about 30 seconds. And if you have listened to Real Recovery before, you know that you can go to the website, myfaithradio.com, go to the Real Recovery page, and you'll see all the podcasts there of all of our shows and previous guests. And if you hear a testimony that you think would really be good for a friend or a family member or a coworker, what a great way to introduce the gospel to someone through a powerful, powerful story. You can go check that out at myfaithradio.com. So we'll take a little break, and then in about 3 minutes or so, we're going to bring Stu onto the show. You're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. So glad you're with us tonight. We're always glad you're with us. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us tonight. What would your world be like, again, if you were a angry, atheistic alcoholic and a millionaire? That's kind of cool. And once again, our guest, Stu Fallendorf, is all of that. He, between the ages of 30 and 44, he had taken 3 companies public. Self-sufficiency was his God, and then it all fell apart. Lots to tell about his story. Stu, welcome to the show.
Thanks much.
So, I'm very interested, as is George, about your path. You've got a lot on your resume.
Well, I'm happy to tell you a little bit about it.
Well, let's get started.
Great. Well, I was, as you just mentioned, a businessman. I grew up in Colorado, and by the time I was 29 years old, I had gone to business school. I'd gotten married to my wife, beautiful wife, Trish. I had gotten my MBA, and at 29 years old, became the CFO, Chief Financial Officer of the first company, which was in the electronics manufacturing industry. And from that point forward, my career took off. I was starting to get kind of what I wanted out of life, at least what I thought I wanted. I grew up in a seeker-friendly house or seeker household, meaning my grandparents and my parents were looking for answers. My grandparents were Jehovah's Witnesses for a period of time, and then they weren't anything for a period of time. My parents seemingly had a wonderful marriage, and then they got divorced when I was 14 after 16 years of marriage, and I kind of turned to myself along the way. So my first business job as being a business executive was really kind of the culmination of a lot of self-will and self-focus.
That usually is the way it starts, isn't it? But you had success doing that, so it kind of reinforces it.
It did, and so I liked the industry very much. It was building technology products, and I was employee number 55 in 1992 when I came on board, and then by 1994 we had grown enough that we considered taking the company public through an initial public offering. And of course, in those days, we were a smaller company than many companies can go public now, but we were able to do that. We had underwriters, Dane Bosworth, which isn't around anymore, but some other co-managers and underwriters, and we took the company public, and after that kind of came into some money and didn't put any of the money away, didn't save any money. It was all basically about me accomplishing what I wanted, and I went out and bought a, you know, brand new racing green Jaguar and put a brand new bar in my basement. And my wife and I felt like it would never be a rainy day, and so we went out and we really were worshiping ourselves in many ways. My wife wasn't a Christian at the time either, and we just went out and kind of indulged on ourselves.
That sounds pretty exciting to me, Bill.
That's a natural response to everything I've heard.
You know, you take your company and do an IPO with it, and all of a sudden everybody's telling you how great you are, and you got all this money, and that would be very intoxicating.
And a nice, cool new car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was beautiful. I mean, it broke down when I drove out of the parking lot, but I had it repaired, got it to my house, and it just broke up. I hope there's nobody out there who's selling Jaguars, but I had some real problems with it. But it was a beautiful car. I mean, absolutely beautiful. It was a real monument to myself.
Yeah.
So how long was it until that wasn't good enough and you had to do another deal?
I had a sense of dissatisfaction from the very beginning, to be honest with you. By the time 1994 rolled around, I was starting to develop my worldview around atheism, Christopher Hitchens, and the like, and was really becoming more and more argumentative against any kind of a Christian worldview. At the same time, it was a little bit like Ecclesiastes. It seemed like vanity, vanity. So I was trying to accomplish more and more. We grew the company to 1,400 employees. We moved the company's headquarters to Denver, Colorado, so we could be closer to the airport. I handled mergers and acquisitions along with the financials of the business, and we bought other companies and we merged them together. And so by the time 1998, 99 rolled around and I was named to the board of directors in 1997, 98, that time frame. But by the time, I was really starting to question, hey, what's this all about? How come I'm not feeling better about it? We had 1,400 employees. The company was named the number one public company in Colorado in 1998. I had an office right next to the CEO, was on the board of directors with people like Dick Monfort, who owns the Colorado Rockies, and Bob McNamara, a pretty well-known guy in the Northeast. And I was just feeling dissatisfied. And so by the end of 1999, I put my name out at the headhunters and thought, well, you know, if I moved into another area of technology business, maybe some of the answers that I was searching for would be, you know, some of the questions I was asking, the answers would come. And so that's what I did. And so I put my name out there to look at other businesses to go be an executive at.
So, Stu, when did you start to do some stress relief in the form of self-medication?
So my first drink, I was actually a freshman in college, and I can tell you that the first I can remember, which is often the case with alcoholics, I can remember my first drink like it was yesterday. And so I was a freshman in college, and then from that point forward, alcohol was a part of my life all the time. I mean, I wouldn't say that I was a functioning alcoholic when I was younger, but you know, between the partying, graduating from college, going to work at Club Med and drinking and doing some drugs there. And, you know, there was never a part of my life that I can remember that alcohol wasn't part of it. And then as I became a more, quote, successful business person, the alcohol became a bigger part of leaving work and going and doing business planning with other colleagues at a bar with a bar napkin. And there was just never a part. And so alcohol in my life became a bigger and bigger part of both celebration, of joy, looking for answers in all the wrong places, filling that hole in my heart, and also medicating because of stress. So it wasn't all stress, guys. It was actually all aspects of life. Alcohol was a part of my life.
No, I get that totally, and it makes things a lot better, and it's kind of a reward, and it's your stress relief, and very social. You haven't mentioned any golf. Did you join a country club and playing with all your buddies?
Sure.
Okay.
I did. We belonged to Hiwan Country Club up in Evergreen, which was a beautiful golf course. They used to hold the Colorado Open there. We played golf, hung out with the buddies, spent the weekends there drinking with the buddies and playing poker and that whole country club lifestyle. Absolutely.
And that's very reassuring.
George really likes you, by the way, right now, Stu.
That's very reinforcing. I mean, because it's fun, and here you're, you know, being rewarded with all this, but it sounds like, Bill, what I'm hearing is – it's not good enough. It's just not good enough. There's got to be more here. And so you put your name out. You're looking for another job because it's not you. It's got to be the job, right?
Absolutely. I felt like, you know, we had grown the company 1,400 and had some money, and we'd even did a secondary offering. And for some reason, it just wasn't good enough. And so I put my name out to Headhunter and got called and met the CEO at Denver International Airport for a company called MetaWave Systems, which was in Seattle. And they were just getting ready to go public, if people remember this time period, heading into the turn of the century, you know, the whole Y2K thing. The technology market was just going crazy. And this was a telecommunications company that developed software and hardware systems. And so I met him, and within 3 weeks of another IPO, they offered me the job. And so after 8 years at EFTC, I told the board I was resigning and I was going to go pursue this job in Seattle. And I felt like the company would be valued at a higher rate because or a higher valuation because they were a software company. And so after 8 years, I up and left and went to Seattle and started a new career there.
So, Stu, I think you would easily admit that you were struggling with self-sufficiency, and you had a big dose of ego and maybe struggled with materialism because nothing was good enough, right?
That's right. And, of course, my theology, we can talk a little bit about after I became a Christian, but my theology was really around looking for answers to, it's a very sort of classic theological view of Blaise Pascal saying filling that empty hole in your heart with the idols of the world. And, you know, Genesis 4 through Revelation, the Bible is really about that struggle that human beings have with idols. And so I was looking for, you know, if I guess you'd say love or meaning in all the wrong places. And you know, later on in life, I would read the books like Ecclesiastes and, you know, would read Vanity of Vanities, All Vanity, you know, and all these things that this wise King Solomon was saying. And I recognized that that's exactly what was going on. Additionally, I was becoming a functional and later a non-functional alcoholic. And one of the things that happens in recovery is, or before recovery is, people who are addicts and alcoholics, they tend to geographically move quite a bit because they're looking for answers. And so they'll go from one place to another thinking that, oh, my addiction will escape me, or if I move from here to there, it'll be different. And of course, what always ends up happening is, since it's a physical and spiritual condition, is that darn addiction just keeps following you where you go.
Yeah. Stu Fullendorf is our guest. He has got quite a story, and he's also written a book called Wall Street to the Well, Story of Transformation from Fortune to Faith. Take a break and be back with more of Stu in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. We're having a great conversation tonight with Stu Fullendorf. He's written a book called Wall Street to the Well, a story of transformation from fortune to faith. What a story. He was a Wall Street whiz kid and took three companies public on the NASDAQ by his early 40s. That's quite an accomplishment. But there was still quite a hole in his heart. And, you know, I think Pascal talked about that we've got this God-shaped vacuum that God is not in that space, we'll try to fill it with everything else. And sounds like that's what Stu was trying to do, Georgie.
Yeah, and he sounds like an all-in guy. So he's going to, you know, wrap this up a little bit because I've got game. I've been rewarded. I'm good at this. And if it's not good enough, I just got to, you know, wrap it up. I got another gear.
Yeah.
So we're going to move out to Seattle, I guess.
Yeah, so Stu, heading to Seattle, was that, in your opinion, a fresh start for a new identity or just more money or a new opportunity? What was the purpose of going to Seattle?
Yes, to all those.
Okay.
I was looking for higher valuations of the company at the time period before the telecom market collapsed. A lot of these startup companies were being valued at a very high level. My wife had become a Christian in the late 90s, 1997, 98 time period, and we were in a very difficult situation because I was highly critical of her growing faith, and so I felt discomfort and dissatisfaction at home. And at the same time, I was looking for significance, though I was attaining everything that I had wanted as I was thinking about going to business school and becoming a young business executive. And for some reason, it simply wasn't satisfying me. And so we ended up moving to Seattle. And right after the company went public, it wasn't more than – in fact, it was on the IPO roadshow for MetaWave that, if people remember this time period, that the NASDAQ dropped at an all-time record. And yep. We were right in the middle of the – initial public offering roadshow. When it happened, we were still able to take the company public. But from that point forward, for the next couple of years, two or three years, it was very difficult because we lost our customers. And then the business ended up, like many of those small startups, unraveling in bankruptcy when the telecommunications bubble burst.
So you're out west and your company's going on you. Did you keep your job or were you laid off? What happened?
Yes, so I helped work the company through a bankruptcy after going public, and then took some time to go find out what I was going to do next. And the CEO of EFTC, the company that was in Colorado, had gone to work as an investment banker, and he called me and said, you know, would you like to come out and be an investment banker doing mergers and acquisitions work in Chicago? So I took the job. I ended up going back and forth between Chicago and Seattle. And at the same time period, my wife, who was growing more and more in love with Jesus, was asking me to go to church with her. She found a church she absolutely adored and loved the preaching. And I kept telling her no and no. And so finally, through the kind of suffering of the business that we had moved out to take public, through some of the suffering and just some of the things I was hearing from her and how her life was changing, I finally went to church for the first time in 2003 with her. And it was partly because of how I was feeling about significance, and it was just partly because I was seeing how her life was transforming.
Stu, how are you feeling at this point about what the Bible would describe as being unequally yoked between you and your wife?
I was angry. I was, my wife would leave.
Sorry.
My wife, yeah, my wife would
George
leave.
George laughs at inappropriate times.
Yeah, I do.
So you know.
I'm sorry. But...
I know. I was angry. I could not understand why she got interested in what I thought was religion, though, as I found out, it was really a deep relationship with Jesus. And so my wife, who was praying for me daily, and if you look at many women, would have left me because I was actually verbally abusive. She would be reading the Bible, and I would come downstairs, and I didn't like the fact she was reading the Bible. I was an arguing atheist at the time, so I wasn't ambivalent about it. And so we had a very difficult time period from about 1998 to 2003. Now, what ended up happening from 2003 through 2005 is my heart started to soften some. I actually went to church for the first time. I heard a sermon. It wasn't exactly a seeker-friendly sermon, but it worked for me on predestination. And the pastor was yelling from the pulpit that I wasn't God, and I thought I was God, at least functionally. And so for a couple years thereafter, I would go often. Then my wife would ask me to go to her community group, her life group. I wouldn't go. I finally went and liked the people. I could see how their faith was transforming them. And there was an 80-year-old truck driver and his wife, and he just loved on me, and I found out he was actually evangelizing me. But I liked the people, so I went more and more to that. So we did. It was a very difficult time period. I can tell you, we had an anniversary. I talk about this in the book. We had an anniversary where we went to a high-end restaurant named Candles in Seattle, and my wife was saying, you know, I know we've had our issues, but, you know, I love you. And I said, I think you're a nut job. I think you're a Jesus freak. And it didn't go over well. And so that's kind of where we were at the time. Then between 2003 and 2006, you know, my heart did start to soften, and I talk about that in the book a little bit, but I still wasn't a Christian. I would go to the life group, and I wouldn't pray, but I was at least starting to understand a little bit about where she was coming from.
I think we need to go back to that, Phil. So you tell your wife she's a nut job, and it doesn't go over real well.
it's
real
hard to believe.
Yeah, no.
What point in the meal did you say that? Had you had your food yet?
A couple drinks.
She didn't throw anything at me, but I do remember that because she was more gracious. But to say that the decorum and the atmosphere of our dinner deteriorated from that point forward would be an understatement.
Sure.
You know, it's really interesting to hear all this, and there's parallel tracks going on. But God's in control of both of them. And, you know, you see this through the rearview mirror, Billy, and it's like this would be a disaster. We struggled with our marriage for 5 years. Most people would find that too long to endure, but yet they stay together, and his wife's getting stronger for the Lord. But he heard about predestination and that he's not God the first time he goes to the church. Not an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, Stu, safe to say that you were living in a kind of an idolatrous culture with kind of a worship disorder?
Yeah, that's right. I'll just give you a sense of it. At one point, I went out and bought a piece of property in Edmonds Woodway when my wife was visiting her family in Colorado. I paid $900,000 for the property without asking her. And I called her up, and I told her what I had done, and she just said, "Are you sure? Are you sure about this?" And I had this, and this is a 2006, because I had gone to work for a company called Isilon Systems, which I knew was going to be a big tech high-flying IPO, and which is going to be a very hot company. And so I borrowed against what was the value of my stock options, and I was going to build about 8,000 square foot Mediterranean villa on 2 acres in Edmonds Woodway. And I actually pulled the trigger on it without even asking my wife about it. And so I was, again, at this point, and this is right before I became a Christian, I was literally trying to do everything I could to find answers and meaning, and spending more and investing more and trying to make more money. And yet along the way, no matter what I was doing, even building temples to myself, which is what that house was going to be, I was still feeling a greater and greater discontentment about my purpose in life, regardless of how much money I had. And I was really, really struggling and suffering. And so I was drinking more and medicating myself more, and I was getting even angrier, though I was starting to see a softened heart about the prospect of maybe there is a God. But it was a hard time period.
You know, we look on those as, you know, random awakenings that God puts in our life, and all of a sudden, this isn't working for me anymore. Could you tell you were sliding away, you know, spiritually and mentally? Was it really becoming a drag on you the whole life?
I think so. I'm not so sure whether it was a spiritual condition or how conscious I was of it, but I knew that something wasn't right. And I could see, it's not unlike Lee Strobel's story, if you know of Case for Christ, I could see my wife's life changing and transforming to the good. And I could see how I was getting what I thought I wanted, and yet it wasn't satisfying.
And God allows that. But I got to tell you, listening to your story, and I've never heard it before, we've never talked before now, you would have been a guy I would have loved to hang out with. I mean, you know, you just sound fun. And it's like, you know, what's wrong with this? Everything's successful. And yet, on the other hand, here's your wife, and she's going towards Jesus. And you're seeing that. And at what point did that become really attractive to you as a refuge from what your life was like?
Well, as we were getting ready to head into the last year before I became a Christian and my heart was softening, it was very clear that the company I was with I could be worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars, if not longer term, hundreds of millions. And I was starting to recognize that as important as that seemed at the time, it still wasn't satisfying, and I could see my wife not really caring about that. And I was sitting there trying to conserve, and I had fear over losing it, and I was living in this in high anxiety, fearful life, and my wife had this sense of comfort and peace that I simply didn't understand. And so as we were getting ready to take the Isilon Systems public, it was about that time period where I was really, and I talk about this in the book, I was really looking. I had read, my wife used to leave books around the house, hoping that I would read them, and it would really irritate me. And she would leave books like Born Again by Chuck Colson, or some guy who got saved in a cave, or, you know, the Bible and so forth. And I started sneaking reading. I didn't want her to know that I was reading those books, but I started sneaking and reading. So I read Chuck Colson's book, Born Again, and I was about the same age as him, about what happened with him and his conversion, and how he had read Mere Christianity, the second part of Mere Christianity on the great sin, which is pride, where C.S. Lewis says pride is the sin that makes all those sins seem like mere flea bites. And right before we were leaving on the IPO roadshow for Isilon Systems, I read all of Mere Christianity, and though I wasn't a Christian and born again, I could actually sense that something was going on in my heart as I was leaving for the IPO roadshow.
So, Stu, I would love to hear now, at what point did you have your born-again experience when you decided that the evidence of Christ was what it said it was, and you embraced it and believed it. And that's all that's up next. I'm going to take a little break, if you don't mind. When we come back, we'll hear that testimony from Stu Fullendorf. He's written a book called Wall Street to the Well, A Story of Transformation from Fortune to Faith. Thank you for listening to Real Recovery tonight. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. We have Stu Fullendorf on our studio line, a Wall Street whiz kid. He took three companies public on the NASDAQ by his early 40s. And now we're at a point where his wife has come to faith in Christ, leaving books out all over, hoping he would read them. And he's sneaking them. He's reading them in a sneaky fashion because he doesn't want her to know that he's getting more and more interested. And then comes to a point where he decides the claims of Jesus are real, and then you come to a saving faith in Christ. Stu, tell us about that.
In late November of 2006, Isilon Systems was going public through an initial public roadshow, a big high-flying tech IPO led by Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and some big money managers on Wall Street. And so we had a G10 jet ready to fly out to sell stock for 2.5 weeks, and we got through our first week, and then we flew over to London, England, and we were we were staying at the Savoy Hotel that evening. And this is the evening of December 7th, 2006. We had Indian food in the Soho district of London with the investment bankers, and after we had our wine and cocktails and Indian food dinner, we were walking down Market Street in Soho, and one of the investment bankers looked up at a building and said, "That's where Karl Marx wrote his Communist Manifesto for the Workers' Union," and there was a name that he used. And then there was kind of a joke by one of the investment bankers saying, "Yeah, it's a good thing that Marx wasn't correct about that, huh?" And we all kind of chuckled. And then one of the guys in the party said, "But one thing is for sure, religion is definitely the opiate of the masses. We wouldn't have all the conflicts we have in the world without religion." And I kind of said, "Yeah, that's right." We got in our limousine, went back to the Savoy Hotel, and of course, remember, this is after a couple of years, 3 years of listening to preaching and my heart softening, and I started going to a men's Bible study, even though I wasn't a Christian, and my wife's life group. Went back to the hotel room and passed up on going and having cocktails with the guys for probably the first time on the roadshow. Went into my room and sat in this lambskin chair and thought, what would the world be like without Jesus Christ? Yeah, I started thinking about that comment about religions causing conflicts, and then I started thinking, yeah, the world is fallen. I've learned that. Yeah, the world is broken. Yeah, there's sin everywhere. We live in a tough world, but what would the world be like without Jesus Christ? And at that point, I felt the Holy Spirit move in. I had tears in my eyes, and I just thought, I've had this all wrong. And I repented and said, and I came to Christ and said, "Lord, I'm sorry. I've been rebellious. I've argued against you. I haven't murdered Christians like the Apostle Paul, but I may have murdered their souls." And I laid down on the ground in the Savoy Hotel and literally sobbed and repented all night long and came to Christ and reflected on the grace and mercy of a loving God to take some, you know, angry, narcissistic, 300-pound alcoholic and pull him to himself. And that's how it happened for me.
Wow. So then when God saves you, he usually has a plan for your life. I'd love to hear about that.
I got up the next morning and gave a presentation, and one of our board members, Barry Feidelman from Atlas Ventures, came up and said, you seem different. Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm okay, but I was already different." We went through the whole IPO process. The price of the stock got priced. We had a closing party, and then the price of the stock doubled on the first day of trading. So I was worth eight figures on paper, and went back, and my life got a lot harder. It didn't get easier. I'll be honest with you. The one of the things, particularly as a 43-year-old, I see these people say that they're saved. I think it's wonderful, and I hear their testimony, and then they say they kind of float off the stage and say, you know, my life got great. My life got shaken. I didn't tell my wife initially what happened. Hebrews 12:25 says, God will shake that which is shakable to leave the unshakable to remain. He certainly did that to me. I had to come to terms with false worldviews of atheism, false political views, false cultural views, and more importantly, false theological views that I had to work through. Additionally, I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, but I was struggling mightily with the flesh and could not drink. And so I got fired, and my attitude about business changed somewhat. And a year later, I got fired from the business along with the CEO. And so I lost my identity in the job. And I got fired for a variety of reasons, but one of them is my heart was changing, and I was starting to care more and more about ministry and like hotel rooms on the street as opposed to, you know, fancy hotel rooms. And so it took a few years from 2006 to about 2009 or 10. I cashed out my stock options. I bought a wine distributorship, which a good alcoholic will always do. And then, you know, drank more and more with the wine distributorship. When the 2008 recession hit, after cashing out the options, we were over-levered as we bought this business, and our business struggled. And at the same time, in 2010, I got a DUI as I was drinking more and more, and then I went to rehab. And I went to rehab, and it was one of the great spiritual experiences of my life. My wife and I actually smuggled Bibles into rehab, and when I got out of rehab, I relapsed for a short period of time, and then in October or in December of 2010, it was the last drink that I had. And praise God, through struggles, I've been sober ever since. So, what happened to me after being saved is I had a growing joy in my life through suffering, and there was a few years of real broken suffering where I started understanding God's purpose in his hand in suffering, that God will discipline those whom he loves, that he will also love you through that, but at the same time, there's a price to be paid, as King David paid for his sins, for the sins of our lives. And so, it wasn't like I became a Christian and then I fluttered off the stage and things got great. That's not what happened with me, but things started to improve to the point where all those moleheads were getting whack-a-moled, to the point of, you know, of me growing in Christ and being more and more sanctified. But for me to get there, guys, I lost my money. The business went under. I had to go through rehab. And through all of that, I just felt this growing sense of God's purpose and joy in my life. As I was suffering, I felt a growing sense of joy. Happy? No, not necessarily. But joy, absolutely. And so after 2010 rolled around and got sober, lost the money, all that. At one point, I went to my wife and said, I just feel like I need to get to know God more. And I would like to go to seminary, and I don't know what it's going to be. I didn't have an intention of being a pastor, but I just want to go to seminary and learn more and more about God and just dive deeper and deeper into a deeper understanding. And she just gave me a big hug, and she said, of course. And so we went out and looked for the seminary we want to go to, and Denver Seminary was an excellent seminary, happened to be in our home state, and so I came back and started my MDiv program and got my Master of Divinity degree at Denver Seminary.
Wow, what a story.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I got a question for you. When you got out of rehab, how do you and how did you stay sober?
Oh, yeah, it was hard. Getting sober was the hardest thing. I dropped 100 pounds, which was hard too. But getting sober was the hardest thing I've ever done, and because of that, I love recovery ministry. So we've started Celebrate Recoveries. I go to AA meetings with people. In fact, yesterday I just checked a congregation member into rehab. But for me, sobriety is still a day-to-day proposition, even as a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you, for whatever reason, and this is why I use the term worship disorder, that booze, those drugs, they give you that what seemingly counterfeit spiritual uplifting that seems to just get into every cell of your body. And it took me a real understanding through recovery, through 12 steps, through being involved in the recovery community to realize how fragile sobriety really is and how hard it is to truly give it up. And I'm convinced that there's a spiritual dimension to this. Well, we know it is, because we know about AA and we know the spiritual aspects of it. That to break through and to break through that counterfeit worship, that worship disorder that's given to us by the feeling that we get from drugs and alcohol, is really, really hard for people. And if you haven't struggled with an addiction like that in the past, the people who have, they understand it. But the people that haven't, it's really hard to understand how devastating and how hard it is to get sober. And so it was very, very hard. I relapsed after rehab. It was about 6 weeks of just sheer despair. Got a sponsor, worked the 12 steps, got into sober recovery, got more and more in my spiritual practices and so forth. And so by the time I finally got sober, it was just a big effort to get there.
Stu, did your wife start to like you better?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think our lives are, she'd be better to speak to it. I could tell you, my relationship with my wife is amazing. It's completely transformed. She's number two in my life after Jesus. I'm number two in her life after Jesus. Because of that, we have that commonality of ministry and our love for Christ that overruns everything. We understand marriage is the covenantal model that God gave us, just as Jesus loves the church. And so our life is completely different now, and it's beautiful, it's wonderful. We still struggle, we still argue, you know. I get up and preach at our church and say, hey, you know, my wife and I argued before we get, you know. So we're human beings, but our life is totally different now than it was being unequally yoked, or me being a drinker, or even when we first got married, where neither one of us were Christians. Our life has significance and meaning beyond anything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. And what would be some of your secrets to success at home?
Well, I think, you know, the Bible is always the answer. So where the Bible says, you know, treat your wife as Jesus treats the church. You know, men have a responsibility to man up and treat their wives with dignity and respect and love, as Christ sets a pretty high standard. And so we have to be gracious and merciful to ourselves through a loving God, the understanding that we never quite get there. But we do our best to try to do that. And at the same time, you know, a biblical understanding of the wife as ontologically equal, but a supporter of her husband, a husband that loves his wife as Jesus loves the church, a service attitude, a love for each other that is driven by God and God alone. And when you make Christ the center of your marriage, it's amazing how it works out in such a way.
Mm-hmm. Stu, we're just got a minute left or so. Your book comes out April 9th, is that right?
It does.
All right, and the book is Wall Street to the Well, a story of transformation from fortune to faith. What a delightful person you are, and what an incredible story of transformation that God has taken you through. It's really is, our listeners are just loving you and loving this story.
Yeah, I really appreciate your honesty, because it's hard to get sober. And I get the thing like buying the house when your wife's gone. Of course she'll love it. I love it, you know? And I mean, the whole deal that God has given you, obviously a lot of ability, but the one thing I'm hearing is somebody who's in recovery is how honest you are. And that's just great. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Stu.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Yep.
God be the glory.
Thank you. Stu Fallendorf has been our guest, Wall Street to the Well, a story of transformation from fortune to faith. That wraps up our show. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next week, God willing. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.